The Guardian.
You're listening to The Guardian Short Story Podcast, featuring great authors reading and discussing their favourite short story. In this edition, we feature Rose Tremaine, who was chosen to read Extra by Yi-Yun Lee.
Granny Lin walks in the street on a November afternoon with a stainless steel lunch pail in her hand. Inside the lunch pail is an official certificate from her working unit. Hereby we confirm Comrade Lin Mei is honourably retired from Beijing Red Star Garment Factory, says the certificate, in bright golden characters. It does not say that Red Star Garment Factory has gone bankrupt, or that, being honourably retired, Granny Lin will not receive her pension. Of course, it will not provide such information, for these facts are simply not true. Bankrupt is the wrong word for a state-owned industry. Internal reorganisation is what has been kindly omitted in the certificate. And mind this, Granny Lin's pension is being withheld only temporarily. For how long, the factory has no further information to offer. But where on earth can she find a way to replenish her dwindling savings? For a few days, Granny Lin adds, subtracts, and divides. And she decides that her savings will run out in a year, or in 2 years, if she can skip a meal here and there, go to bed right after sunset, and stay bundled up so that she does not have to feed the insatiable stove extra coal balls through the long winter of northern China. "Don't worry," Auntie Wang says the next time they meet each other at the market, looking down at the single radish Granny Lin has bought for her dinner, as plump as a Buddha, dwelling between her two palms. "You can always find someone and get married." "Get married," Granny Lin says and blushes. "Oh, don't be so conservative, Granny Lin," Auntie Wang says. "How old are you?"
51.
"You're even younger than I am. I'm 58, but I'm not as old-fashioned as you. You know what? Young people no longer have a monopoly on marriage." "Don't make me a clown," Granny Lin says. "I'm serious, Granny Lin. There are so many old widowers in the city. I'm sure there are rich and sick ones who need someone to take care of them."
"You mean I can find a caretaker's position for old people?" Granny Lin asks. Auntie Wang sighs and pokes Granny Lin's forehead with a finger.
"Use your brain. Not a caretaker, but a wife. That way, you can at least inherit some cash when your husband dies."
Granny Lin gasps. She has never had a husband in her life, and the prospect of a dead husband frightens her. Yet Auntie Wang makes the decision for her right there and then, between two fish stands, and in a short time she finds Granny Lin a match.
76, high blood pressure and diabetes. Wife just died, living alone in a three-bedroom flat. Pension, 2,000 yuan a month. Both sons married and earning good money in the government, Auntie Wang says, surprised that Granny Lin remains unimpressed.
Oh, come on, Granny Lin. Where else can you find such a good husband? The old man will die in no time. And the sons are so rich, they won't mind sparing some of the old man's savings for you.
Let me tell you, this is the most eligible family, as far as I know. Their door sill has been worn away by the feet of the matchmakers. But of all the possible wives, they are interested only in you. Why? Because you never married and you have no children.
Why don't they hire someone to take care of him? Granny Lin asks, thinking of the two sons who might soon become her stepchildren.
Won't it be cheaper in the long run? Do you not know what those girls from the nanny market are like? They're lazy and they steal money. Husbands too, if they're hired by young couples. They leave the old people sitting in their own shit all day long. To hire such a girl, it would only push him to death quicker.
Granny Lynn has to agree that indeed an older woman as a wife is a wise choice. Accompanied by Auntie Wang, Granny Lynn goes to the interview with the two sons and their wives. An hour of questioning later, the two sons exchange a look and ask if Granny Lynn needs some time to consider the marriage offer. Not having much to think about, she moves into her new home in a week. Her husband, Old Tang, is sicker than she had thought. Alzheimer's, a daughter-in-law tells her at the wedding dinner. Granny Lynn nods, not knowing what the disease is, but guessing that it has something to do with the brain. She supports her husband with both hands and leads him to the table, sitting him down and wiping away the drool from his chin. Granny Lynn becomes a wife, a mother, and a grandmother. She no longer remembers in what year of her life people started to call her Granny Lynn instead of Auntie Lynn. Unmarried women, people believe, age faster. It does not matter anymore because she feels quite qualified for her name. Every week, one of the sons stops by and checks on Old Tang, leaving enough money for the next week. Old Tang is a quiet man, sitting in his chair by the window, immersed in his bottomless silence. Once in a while, he asks Granny Lynn about his wife, and as instructed by the two sons, Granny Lynn replies that his wife is improving in the hospital and will be home in no time. But before she replies, Old Tang seems to have forgotten his question and goes back to his meditation without any sign of having heard Granny Lynn. She waits for more questions that never come and eventually gives up. She turns up the volume of the television and shuffles around the house, sweeping and dusting and wiping and washing. But the time arrives earlier each day when she finishes the housework. Then she sits down on the couch and watches the daytime soap operas. Unlike the 12-inch television Granny Lynn used to own, which required her to make a trip across the room every time she needed to change channels, and altogether she got 6 channels through the antenna made of 2 steel chopsticks. Old Tang's set is a monster with scores of channels, which all obey a small remote control. Dazed by all the choices she has, and by the ease of moving from one selection to another, Granny Lynn soon finds that the machine does her no good. No matter what program she's watching, there is always the nagging worry that she's missing a more interesting one. Granny Lynn sighs and clicks off the television. Old Tang does not notice the silence flooding the room. She realizes that the television is not to blame. It is because of Old Tang's presence that she cannot focus. She picks up an old magazine and peeks at Old Tang from behind the pages. 10 minutes grows into 20 minutes, and she continues looking at him as he insists on not meeting her gaze. She has an odd suspicion that Old Tang is not ill. He knows she is there, and he is observing her secretly. He knows that his wife of 54 years has left him for good, and that Granny Lynn is his new wife, but he refuses to acknowledge her. He pretends to have lost his mind and expects her to play along as if she were a hired caretaker. But Granny Lynn decides not to concede. He is her husband. She is his wife. Their marriage certificate is secure under her pillow. If Old Tang is testing her patience, she is ready to prove it to him. It is a tug of war that Granny Lynn is determined to win. She puts down the magazine and looks boldly into Old Tang's face, trying to outstare Old Tang. Minutes stretch into an hour, and all of a sudden Granny Lynn awakens in a dread that she too is losing her mind. Several times a day, Granny Lynn bathes Old Tang, in the morning and before bedtime, and whenever he wets or dirties himself. The private bathroom is what Granny Lynn likes best about her marriage. For all her life, she has used public bathrooms, fighting with other slippery bodies for the lukewarm water drizzling from the rusty showers. Now that she has a bathroom all to herself, she never misses any chance to use it. Old Tang is the only man Granny Lynn has seen in full nakedness. The first time she undressed him, she could not help stealing a look now and then at the penis nestled in a thinning bush. She wondered what it had looked like in its younger years, but right away chased the unclean thought from her mind. The frail nakedness filled her heart with a tenderness she had never experienced, and she has since tended his body with motherly hands. One evening in late February, Granny Lynn leads Old Tang to the plastic chair in the middle of the bathroom. She unbuttons his pajamas and he bends his arms at her guidance, his head leaning on her shoulder blade. She removes the nozzle and sprays warm water on his body, putting one hand on his forehead so that the water does not get into his eyes. Granny Lynn is squatting on the floor and massaging Old Tang's legs when he touches her shoulder with his palm. She looks up and he is gazing into her eyes. She gives out a cry and backs away from him. "Who are you?" Old Tang says. "Old Tang?" Granny Lynn says. "Is it you? Who are you? Why are you here?" "I live here," Granny Lynn says. She sees an unnatural lucidity in Old Tang's eyes and feels her heart fall. Such a moment of clarity happens only before a nearing death. Granny Lynn had seen the same light 2 years earlier in her father's eyes, hours before he passed away. She thinks of rushing out to call a doctor, but her feet are locked on the floor and her eyes are locked in his eyes. "I don't know you. Who are you?" Granny Lynn looks down at herself. She's wearing a bright yellow plastic poncho and a pair of grass-green rubber boots, her outfit for the bath time. "I'm your wife," she says.
"You are not my wife. My wife is Sujan. Where is Sujan?"
"Sujan is no longer with us. I'm your new wife."
"You're lying," Old Tang says and stands up. "Sujan is in the hospital."
"No," Granny Lynn says. "They lied to you."
Old Tang does not hear her. He pushes Granny Lynn and his arms are suddenly strong. Granny Lynn clutches him, but he is wild with uncontrollable force. She lets go of his hands, not knowing why she needs to fight with her husband over a dead woman. But he is still wrestling with the air, and 2 steps away, slips down in a puddle of soapy water. Nobody pays attention to Granny Lynn at the funeral. She sits in a corner and listens to the men and women who come up to talk about Old Tang's life. An accomplished physicist, and a great teacher, a loving husband, father, and grandfather. The speakers finish and shake the family members' hands, ignoring her at the end of the line. "I did not kill him," Granny Lynn imagines herself telling every person there. "He was dying before the fall." But she does not tell the truth to anyone, and instead admits her negligence. Nobody would believe her anyway, for she alone saw the light in his eyes, the last glimmer before the eternal night, as it is called, the brief moment of lucidity before the end. Granny Lynn does not get a penny from Old Tang's savings. She has looked after Old Tang for only 2 months and has, in many of the relatives' minds, killed him with her carelessness. She does not blame the 2 sons. She can think only of their loss, 1,000 times more painful than her own. And when one of them suggests a job in a private boarding school that is run by his friend, Granny Lynn almost weeps out of gratitude. Situated in a mountain resort in a western suburb of Beijing, Mei Mei Academy takes pride in being among the first private schools in the country.
It occupies one of the few four-storied buildings that were allowed to be constructed in the area. Private schools, like all private businesses, are sprouting up across the country like bamboo shoots after the first spring rain. Relatives of the Communist Party leaders are being transformed overnight into business owners, their faces appearing on national TV as representatives of the new proletariat entrepreneurs. Granny Lynn cannot imagine a better life now that she becomes a maid at the academy. Every meal is a banquet. Meat and fish are abundant. Vegetables are greener than Granny Lynn remembers from her market days. Everything is produced by a small organic farm that serves the president and the premier and their families, so the chef informs Granny Lynn. Sometimes Granny Lynn feels sad at seeing so much good food go into the garbage. She begins to come late to her meals, waiting until the students finish theirs. Throughout the dining hall, untouched vegetables are left withering on the plates. Shipwrecked fishes lie flat on their half-gnawed bellies. Granny Lynn spoons the leftovers onto her plate and dreams of having an express shuttle running between the school and the city every day, taking the unconsumed food to her old neighbours. Eating such good food without working hard is a sin. In addition to the laundry and dorm cleaning assigned to her, Granny Lynn takes on other duties. She gets up early in the morning and opens the classroom windows to let in fresh mountain air. She sweeps and mops the terrazzo floor. She dusts and wipes the students' desks. She makes sure everything is meticulous, even though the janitor has cleaned the classrooms the night before. Sometimes, when there is still time before the wake-up bell, she leaves the school and takes a walk in the mountains. The morning fog is damp on her skin and her hair, and birds she has never seen in the city sing in a chorus. At such moments, Granny Lynn feels overwhelmed by her good fortune. The years in the factory seem a distant dream now, and she no longer remembers what her life was like when she walked through the morning smog, expelled by the coal stoves, and bargained in the market for vegetables, puffed up by chemical fertilisers. The school is growing. Every few months, a few new students arrive. Granny Lynn is stunned by the parents' wealth, the ease with which they pay the initiation fee of 20,000 yuan and another 20,000 for the first year of tuition and room and board. In the third month of Granny Lynn's stay, the school celebrates its 100th student with a feast. Kang, the boy who draws the lucky number, is 6 years old. Unlike the other students who come from the city, he was sent from a nearby province. A few days into his stay, the teachers and the staff members have all heard his story. Kang's grandfather used to be the leader of a big people's commune in his home province, and his father has become one of the top agricultural entrepreneurs in northern China. "I thought farmers liked to keep their sons at home," Granny Lynn says to Mrs. Du, a dorm mother, as they search for the foul-smelling socks under the mattresses. "They can almost stand up and walk by themselves," is how Mrs. Jew describes the stiff socks that have been worn for too long. "Not when he is the son of a disfavoured wife," Mrs. Jew says. "An extra is what he is." Are the parents divorced? Who knows, but the father does have another wife, or a concubine. What's the difference? The boy's mother is no longer needed in the family, and the child has to go too. The thought of the boy, who is so small and occupies almost no space at all in the world, yet who is still in other people's way and has to be got rid of, saddens Granny Lynn. She starts to look for the boy among the crowd. His clothes, of the same brand names as those that the other students wear, look wrong on him. Too large, too new, too trendy. The clothes do not belong to him any more than he belongs to the school. His face and hands always seem in need of a thorough wash, But after Granny Lynn herself has tended to them several times, she has to agree that it's not the child or the doll mother's fault. In the second week, Kang starts to come to the laundry room during the afternoon activity time. "Granny, what's this?" he asks one day while Granny Lynn is massaging some baby lotion into his cheeks.
"Something that will make you a city boy," Granny Lynn says.
"Granny, where do you live?"
"I live here."
"But before you came here, where's your husband's home?"
Granny Lynn thinks for a moment.
"In the city," she says.
"What's a city like? My mum said she'd take me to see the city."
"Where is your mum?" Granny Lynn asks, holding her breath and trying to make her heart beat less loudly. The boy seems not to notice.
"She's at home."
"Your father's home?"
"My grandfather's home. My new mum lives in my father's home."
"What's your new mum like? Is she pretty?"
"Yes."
"Is she good to you?"
"Yes."
"Do you like her?"
"Yes."
"Do you like your mum also, more than your new mum?" Granny Lynn asks.
She turns around to see whether anyone is walking past the laundry room in the hallway. She feels like a thief. The boy too turns around nervously. He then comes closer and circles his arms around Granny Lynn's neck, his mouth to Granny Lynn's ear, his hot breath touching her earlobe.
"Granny, I'll tell you a secret. Don't tell anyone."
"I won't."
"My mum said she would come and get me back one day."
"When?"
"She said soon, if I don't make my dad and my new mum angry,"
Kang says.
"Granny, do you think the guards will let her in when she comes?"
"I'm sure they will," Granny Lynn says.
The boy smells like a mixture of baby lotion, fresh laundry, and clean sweat. It reminds Granny Lynn of old Tang after his bath, the way a deer person smells good. The thought makes Granny Lynn's lips go dry, and she feels the boy's arms on her neck, hot and sticky. On Friday afternoons, the parking lot outside the school gate is full of luxury cars. Chauffeurs and nannies come, and sometimes the parents themselves show up. Teachers and dorm mothers stand inside the gate, pointing out to one another who is the daughter-in-law of a power figure in the government and who has appeared in the latest hit movie. Kang is the only child who stays for the weekend. His father has paid the extra fee for the weekend care and has promised to come for him at the end of the semester. Sometimes Granny Lynn wonders if the father will ever come and what will become of Kang if no one picks him up when summer comes. Will he be able to stay with her at the school? Then she wonders if she herself will be allowed to stay, and if not, where she will spend the 2 months before she is allowed back in September. After the last student is picked up every weekend, the teachers and the dorm mothers leave on a shuttle bus for the city. Apart from the two guards, Granny Lynn is the only one who stays, and she has cheerfully agreed to take care of Kang. They stand side by side at the school gate and wave at the bus. Both sigh with relief once it is gone. Kang darts across the yard to the activity room, flipping through the picture books as fast as he can, eager to get to the next one. Granny Lynn comes in and sits down at his side, stroking his hair and watching him laugh to himself. When he finishes all the new books, they go out together and play in the yard, Granny Lynn pushing him in the swing until he's flying so high that Kang screams with excitement and fear. When the weather is nice, they take long walks in the mountains. Weekend tourists swarm into the area, but Granny Lynn and Kang are the only two people who do not worry about missing the bus or getting stuck in a traffic jam. They walk hand in hand, Kang's palm touching Granny Lynn's palm, both sweating. Granny Lynn tells old tales about flowers and grasses. When she runs out of stories, she makes up new ones. After dinner, Granny Lynn leads Kang to the bathroom. She waits outside with a towel and his pajamas, and he sings in the shower the song about the red dragonfly she has taught him. Always he shouts to Granny Lynn after the first 2 minutes, asking if he can come out now. She replies it would be good if he could stay in the shower for another 5 minutes. The boy goes on singing, his voice pure and perfect. Often, without turning off the water, Kang jumps out of the stall at Granny Lynn. She pretends to be startled and screams, and he giggles and runs off before she can wrap the towel around his dripping body. At night, as he sleeps, he mumbles in his dreams, his arms and legs thrown to all four directions on the blanket. Granny Lynn tucks him in and watches him for a long time, the unfamiliar warmth swelling inside her. She wonders if this is what people call falling in love, the desire to be with someone for every minute of the rest of her life, so strong that sometimes she is frightened of herself. Granny Lynn is not the first person to have noticed the missing socks. The dorm mothers for 2 weeks in a row tell her that the girls are complaining that their favourite socks are disappearing in the laundry. Granny Lynn knows then what has happened to the socks. A few times she has seen Kang clutch a girl's unwashed sock. He drops it into the basket when he realises that she's watching him. The next weekend, while Kang is playing a computer game in the activity room, Granny Lynn searches his bed. She finds nothing under the mattress where the kids usually hide things. She folds back the blanket. She picks up the pillow and unzips the pillowcase and sees 5 socks inside, rolled up into small bundles like newborn bunnies. Granny Lynn unrolls them. Young girl socks with flowered patterns or cartoon animals. She thinks of putting them in her own pocket, but stops at the thought of Kang groping in the pillowcase for the socks. Something dear to him, for reasons she does not know. She rolls the socks back up and stuffs them into the pillowcase. On Monday, Granny Lynn asks her supervisor for a half a day off and takes the bus to the city, looking for socks with the same patterns as the missing ones. She buys several more packs of girls' socks in different designs. Granny Lynn becomes more careful with the laundry now. She makes sure all the girls' socks are in their bags before Kang arrives. From time to time, she scatters around socks that she has bought, all of them having been washed and dried and then rubbed across the floor. They are still the happy couple on weekends, but Granny Lynn worries as she counts the missing socks that she has put out for Kang. She wonders if she needs to talk to him and find out the reason for what he's doing. But every time she opens her mouth, she loses her resolve. On weekends, as they sit in the shadow of the wisteria, Granny Lynn wonders if this is the love she missed in her younger years, hand in hand with a dear boy, not asking him to tell her the secret she is not allowed to know. The weather gets hot and the dorm mothers put mosquito nets over the students' beds. The first night, a boy in the bed next to Kang's gets up after the dorm mother leaves. With a small flashlight in his hand, he sticks his head into Kang's mosquito net and shrieks in a low voice, letting the flashlights shine in Kang's eyes. Kang does not cry, as the boy hopes, but the boy is surprised and pleased to find Kang stroking his own cheeks with both his hands in floral socks. Dorm mothers are called. 7 more socks are discovered. And by the end of the day, everyone in the school knows about the sick boy who steals girls' socks and does strange things with them. Granny Lynn watches the kids chase Kang around the schoolyard, calling him sicko, psycho, porn boy. Her heart is wrenching, as if it were a piece of rag in the washing machine. Kang is no longer allowed to visit the laundry room. She counts the days to the weekend and is afraid that she will break down before the 3 days pass. On Friday afternoon, as they stand in front of the school gate, Granny Lin has to raise Kang's hand up and wave for him. When the shuttle bus is gone, Granny Lin turns to Kang, who is kicking a pebble in front of him. "Kang, come to Granny's room for a moment," Granny Lin says.
"No, I don't want to,"
Kang says, letting go of Granny Lin's hand. "What do you want to do? Let's take a walk."
"I don't want to take a walk."
"How about reading some books? A new case of books came in yesterday."
"I don't want to read."
"Let's get up on the swing."
"I don't want to do anything," Kang says, pushing Granny Lin's hand away from his shoulder.
Granny Lin's tears swell out of her eyes. She looks down at the top of Kang's head. To love someone is to want to please him, even when one is not able to. "Think of something you want to do, and we'll do it together. Think of something you want, and Granny will get it for you. You know Granny loves you."
"I want to go home. I want to see my mum," Kang says. "Granny, do you think we can catch the train and go home for 2 days?
Granny Lin looks down at Kang's upturned face, seeing the small hope grow bigger in his eyes. Kang grabs her hand.
"Granny, just 2 days. Nobody will know."
Granny Lin sighs. "Forgive me, Kang, but Granny cannot do this for you."
"But why? You said you could do anything.
Anything that we can do here, in the school, in the mountains. Kang, good boy, we cannot leave the school." It takes a minute for Kang to burst into tears. Granny Lin tries to quiet him and pull him into her arms. Kang pushes her away, and his eyes, with the cold anger that Granny Lin once saw in old Tang's eyes, chill her. Kang runs across the schoolyard. Granny Lin runs after him, but has to stop and catch her breath after a few steps. Her old body is failing her young heart. Granny Lin thought that Kang would be crying in his bed, but the boy is not there. She calls out his name as she walks in the building, checking each unlocked door, the activity room, the music room, the dining hall. She looks under tables and behind curtains, and her heart sinks deeper each time her hope proves unfounded. For an hour, Granny Lin searches until it occurs to her that the boy may have left the building and even the school. Paralyzed by such a thought and imagining all kinds of disasters, she calls the two guards who are playing poker in the small room by the school gate. Neither wants to admit the possibility that the boy has squeezed through the gate, both insisting that the boy must be hiding somewhere in the building. More searches are carried out by the three of them. When nothing is yielded, they each start to panic with different worries. The police are called. The school supervisor is called. The dorm mothers are called. The guards make phone calls to whomever they can think of. Granny Lin watches one of the young men punch the number with a shaking hand and wonders why he's so nervous. The guards are only losing a peaceful weekend. They will lose, at most, a month's salary, as both are relatives of the trustees. Boys disappear every day. What would they remember of Kang a year from now, even if they never found him again? Granny Lin begins to cry. But Kang shows up by himself, in the middle of the turmoil, unharmed, hungry, and sleepy. He must have played hide-and-seek with Granny Lin while she was looking for him. Or did he want to punish her for disappointing him? Granny Lin does not know. All she knows is what he told the school supervisor, that he fell asleep under the piano. Granny Lin remembers looking under the piano, but nobody trusts an old woman's memory. Besides, what's the difference, even if she is telling the truth? She has proved herself incapable. More stories are remembered of her eating the student's ration, of her carelessness with the laundry. On the evening of the day the children return, Granny Lin is asked to leave. Her things are packed and placed at the gate. A duffel bag. Not heavy, even for an old woman. The happiness of love is a shooting meteor. The pain of love is the darkness following. A girl is singing to herself in a clear voice as she walks past Granny Lin in the street. She tries to catch up with the girl. The girl moves too fast, and so does the song. Granny Lin puts the duffel bag on the ground and catches her breath, still hanging onto the stainless steel lunch pail with her other hand. All the people in the street seem to know where their legs are taking them. She wonders since when she stopped being one of them. Someone runs past Granny Lin and pushes her hard on the back. She stumbles and catches a glimpse of a hand before falling down. A man in a black shirt runs into the crowd with her duffel bag. A woman stops and asks, "Are you all right, Granny?" Granny Lin nods, struggling to recover from the fall. The woman shakes her head and says aloud to the passerby, "What a world! Someone just robbed an old granny." Few people respond. The woman shakes her head again and moves on. Granny Lin sits on the street and hugs the lunch pail to herself. Hungry as people are, it is strange that nobody ever thinks of robbing an old woman of her lunch. That's why she has never lost anything important. The 3,000 yuan of dismissal compensation is safe in the lunch pail, as are several unopened packages of socks, colourful, with floral patterns, souvenirs of her brief love story.
Rose Tremaine, reading Extra by Yi Yun Lee. Rose spoke to Lisa Allardyce of Guardian Review about her choice.
It is both funny and sad, absolutely, in my book, a marvellously alluring, seductive combination in the writing of stories. If you can make something be very touching and powerful, but also that it has humour in it, which a story certainly does. That was certainly one reason. It's done with this extraordinary compassion. I think it's also a very, very well-crafted story, this irony that this 51-year-old person is known as Granny. And I think I will never hear the word granny, the term designated. I've just become a granny. It's quite interesting, this. But I will never hear the term in the same light again, because sort of somehow after reading that story, I think sort of inherent in that word is a feeling of a kind of exclusion from life. This woman, until the moment when the story begins, has not really had a life. She's had a sort of existence on the edge of other people's lives.
And she's at the an end, extra, isn't she?
She's an extra, as well as, and the boy is known as an extra because he's his own mother has been superseded by another wife, and so he's a sort of unwanted child. But in a sense, Granny Lin, the protagonist, is an unwanted person or a person that nobody notices. And suddenly, reasonably late in her life, she finds some meaning, first in the relationship with the man that she marries, this much older man that she marries through a sort of financial arrangement. She finds great tenderness in that relationship. And then when she meets Kang, the lovely six-year-old boy, it is just very powerfully conveyed that what she feels, these feelings are, they're not sexual in any way, but they are very sort of passionate, loving feelings for this child. She's never had any children of her own, but what she feels for this boy is very, very passionate.
The slightly episodic structure is very interesting. So you begin with this woman who's been made redundant from the factory. Then she is married into this marriage of convenience with this sort of dribbling, drooling old man who's possibly got Alzheimer's. And at that point, you have no idea that this relationship is then going to prefigure the much larger one.
I think this sort of what you call the episodic structure is perfect to the story, because we meet her at the beginning of the story where she has reached her first ending. She's been sacked from a job she's had for a long time, and she doesn't know how she's going to manage financially or in any way.
And then the second sort of resolution comes on, which is the marriage to old Tang. And then that ends. And again, so it's a series of endings. And so I think the reader, we have our hearts and our mouths all the way through thinking, when we finally, she gets the job in the school and has this very tender relationship with the boy.
I know, you we finally just long hope not, she's going
you
to
hope,
be
you think
okay.
It's not going to end, you know, that in a sense that she will inherit the title Granny as something positive rather than as something which just makes her invisible.
In an interview that Yi-Yun Lee did just after winning the Guardian Prize, she said that love was... they didn't have a language for love in her family. I mean, I think she's lived in California since 1996, but she grew up in Beijing. And it is very interesting. The language of love, without sounding too corny, is... it's very sweetly done here, isn't it? And it is all about love, again, but not romantic love as we understand it.
And a very, very key aspect of love, which is leaving the other person their freedoms to withhold their own secrets, to cling on to things which are precious to them for reasons that you might intuit, but you don't ask. Absolutely sort of wonderfully key observation about what love is, that you're not asking to know everything of the other person, that you leave them in their own space, and the space that Granny Lin creates first with old Tang, she honours him in a way. She doesn't condescend to him. And again, with the child, and where we're talking about two, they're very vulnerable people, and she treats them with great consideration and honour.
I thought there were very interesting glimpses of China here as well, the new, both old and new, and of a country coming to an end and of transforming itself, first in the closing of the factory and then in the school for the new
absolutely
world.
And these hierarchies. One hierarchy is sort of realigning itself, and then another hierarchy is beginning, and everything is hierarchical, and everything is done sort of by agreement and exchange. In the first instance, the first relationship, I mean, it's a bargain that she makes, really. They think it'll be cheaper to marry the old man off than to have to pay somebody to look after him. So I think the cynicism that has been present in the government has sort of descended through to all strata of society is very well captured here. And the way that the school is set up and again, the hierarchy there with the dorm mothers and the guards and so on.
I think in the end, she still somehow emerges, if not triumphant, uncrushed.
Just about. Although this, if you had to, sort of game readers play with stories, if you had to decide, you know, what happens to her after the story is finished. And I, as a writer, I'm often thinking that. So what now? You know, if you had to take this story on another lap, is she doomed now? I mean, it sort of feels like it to me, that she's tried these various things, she's given her heart to them. This is the point of the story, is that she, late in life, or relatively late in life, she finds two people to which she can give her heart. And in both cases, she's rejected. So it feels to me like a sort of the ultimate defeat at the end.
Rose Tremaine. And you can download all the short stories in this series at guardian.co.uk/books.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.